this Stories of the Pilgrims is a really good book. It comes from Christian Liberty Press. Definitely simplified for the younger folks, and there's some good illustrations there to share that I know the younger folks like. For the older set, there's a book called The Pilgrim Chronicles by Rod Gregg. Definitely probably at the high school level, I guess, but some really good information, also recognizing the Christian beliefs of the pilgrims, not trying to whitewash that over. So two recommendations there. As far as historical references for the pilgrims, kind of the two classic references, first of Plymouth Plantation. You'll notice it's written by William Bradford. He was not the first governor, but we could almost call him the first governor because the first governor died very shortly after he was elected. But William Bradford, you notice the book covers from 1620 to 1647. Now, he started writing this in 1630, substantially completed probably about 1646, but added a little bit more at 1650 to cover the 1647. So this book is not written quite, his information is good, it's considered a classic text that covers the history of the pilgrims, but he started writing it about 20 years after these initial events that we're talking about. The other classic text is called Mort's Relation. Do not ask me who Mort is. There's lots of historical theories about who Mort is, but we don't know who Mort is. Okay. Probably the best guess is that Edward Winslow probably wrote the majority of this text, although others may have been involved as well. However, this was published in 1622, so very, very close to the time of the events that we're talking about. You will see some minor differences, and I might even point out some of those in historical detail that are not particularly important. But if you want to know from firsthand sources what it was like to be a pilgrim and what they did and what happened to them, these are the two books that you want to look at. Also, remembering this, William Bradford's book looks a little bit daunting for those of us who have lives to live. Remember that the early part of the pilgrim history is done fairly early in the book. You don't feel like you have to read the whole thing unless you want to. But there is a lot of good information in both of those books. So let's get started then. As Pastor Bringy pointed out, I suppose we could call it the privilege of talking about, if we want to say, the sun rising. We can think of it as S-U-N or S-O-N or both, that after all this struggle, all this difficulty, all this testing, God shines his light of gracious blessing on the pilgrims having come through this very dark time, particularly the time of this winter disease. I want to give a different statistical backdrop with regard to this sickness that the pilgrims and the sailors had to deal with. About half of the crew of the Mayflower also died. But anyway, if we want to think about this, and imagine there's 100 pilgrims. About half of the husbands and fathers are now dead. 13 of the 18 wives are dead. 19 of the 29 single men are dead. 4 entire families wiped out. 4 of the families that came over, there's nobody left. You only start with 100. So certainly as John pointed out, we had the pilgrims on one hand having to deal with tyranny, on the other hand having to deal with licentiousness. And then, as Reverend Bringy was saying, now having come through both of those and seeking the biblical middle ground between those two extremes, now God has, according to my talk, right, tested them with very hard circumstances. If you want to think of it, God is asking them, are you really devoted to this cause? How much do you really believe in what you're doing? And a little bit of the thunder was stolen in that Reverend Bringy mentioned that when the Mayflower departed, that was actually on April 5th, there were no pilgrims on board. They all stayed. And we can't imagine that because there's no store to go to. There's no, electric power generating company. There's no water and sewer. They're doing everything by hand. In a wilderness where there's no one else except the Indians, where where there's no, I mean, there's the 17th century was not known for its creature comforts, but we're really talking, even in 17th century terms, we're in the backwoods. Now, as we cover from the spring through the first Thanksgiving, I'm going to mention some major historical events, trying to go in chronological order, to show all the ways in which God did shine his light of gracious providence. Obviously, salvation was already there for those who believed in Christ, but in their circumstances, looking up, as it were, as God brings them through the trials of the winter, and also to show their faithfulness to what God says his people ought to be doing as they live their lives. So I'm going to start then with March 16th in 1621. And Samoset, who is a friendly Indian, first makes contact with the pilgrims. Now, this is not their first contact with the Indians, but Samoset basically walks up to the pilgrims. Some people say he said, give me some beer, more or less. And it turns out that Samoset had previously learned English from contact with English fishermen off the coast of Maine. I think a lot of us have grown up with this view that when the pilgrims showed up, the Indians didn't know anything about the white man. And that is utterly and completely untrue. Reverend Bringey talked about the somewhat notorious Captain Thomas Hunt, who caused a lot of trouble for a lot of other people. We'll talk about him in a moment. But anyway, Samoset had picked up a little bit of English, not a whole bunch, but he comes to the pilgrims on March 16th and just makes contact with them and tells them what he can in his limited English about the circumstances around there. He leaves and comes back later in March, and he returns with two very important other Indians. One, we know him as Squanto, although his more proper name is Tisquantum. And then also another Indian by the name of Massasoit. He is the chief of the tribe called the Wampanoags. And I'll try, I hope that that's the only name of an Indian tribe I mentioned, so we don't get too confused with that. But basically, Massasoit and Squanto come to visit the pilgrims, and they visit them on friendly terms. And in fact, what's interesting about Squanto is that he actually ended up residing with the pilgrims until his death only in about 20 months later, in toward the end of 1622. Squanto dies of illness. But God particularly gave Squanto to the pilgrims so that they would survive. We see that he, as we look at the history, he taught them farming, fishing, and hunting. He acted as a translator, and not exactly an ambassador. That was something that more Edward Winslow Moore did. He was always with Squanto as they dealt with other Indian tribes. But certainly Squanto acted as an interpreter because none of the pilgrims knew any Indian dialects. So he helped them with that, and also he would guide them around on expeditions, and especially to find for trading purposes. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Now, an interesting thing about Squanto's past, and again, this should remind us that God orders every little detail of history for his glory and for the good of his people, even though we may not see it in front of us as it's happening. In fact, Squanto had lived in the area where the pilgrims landed. And I won't mention the name of the tribe. I told you I'd try to just stick with the Wampanoags. But anyway, Squanto was in fact kidnapped in 1614 by this English captain, not army captain, but ship captain, Thomas Hunt. Thomas Hunt, in fact, at least on one occasion, kidnapped 20 Indians and took them over and sold them as slaves in Spain. Whether Squanto was in that group of 20, I'm not sure. But Squanto was sold in Spain. And while he was in Europe, in Spain, actually there were some Roman Catholic priests who took pity on what was happening to these Indians and helped them gain their release. Squanto ended up in England and actually worked in the trades for a little bit before he came back to England back to the New World in 1619. Now, while Squanto was in England, the tribe where he was kidnapped from was in fact wiped out by disease in 1617. So here comes Squanto back home 1619, expecting, because there's no newspapers, there's no telegrams or telegraphs or internet or anything else, right? He comes back expecting to come back to his people, and there's nobody. You know, we talk about the last of the Mohicans, right? James Fenimore Cooper. Literally, Squanto is the last of his tribe. He's it. No more. At least not that anybody knows of. And so, as a reminder, Squanto lived with the pilgrims, teaching them and working with them, and teaching them how to live, really. Bradford says of Squanto that he was a special instrument sent of God for their good, the pilgrims' good, beyond their expectation. And this, again, this is only God could say, let's get a Indian kidnapped, let's have him learn English, let's clear out the land so that when the pilgrims land, we don't have to fight the Indians for that piece of land where the pilgrims land. And then let's bring this Indian back so that he can teach my people how to live in this wilderness. Only God could make that happen. Excuse me. By April 1st, there was, in fact, a peace treaty signed with Massasoit. Now, there were six terms to this peace treaty. The first was that they wouldn't hurt each other. That the Indians wouldn't hurt the pilgrims. The pilgrims wouldn't hurt the Indians. That the offending party, if there was injury, was to be turned over to the other group. So if a pilgrim hurt an Indian, the pilgrims would say, okay, Indians, he's yours, you punish him, and vice versa. There was to be a restoration of any stolen property. It's interesting. Quite honestly, the Indians didn't have a whole lot that the pilgrims wanted to steal, but if you read the historical accounts, you'll notice that a lot of times pilgrim tools turned up missing. And it wasn't because the wolves were taking them, right? It was the Indians. So the pilgrims wanted their tools back, right? That was part of the treaty. This was also a mutual defense treaty, that an attack on one would be treated as an attack on the other party. Other Indian tribes were notified of and invited into this peace treaty. It's important to note, I think, that Massasoit, again, I'm not going to mention his tribe, not only was the head of his tribe, but he was also somewhat of a chief of chiefs. There were other tribes whose chiefs ranked lower than Massasoit, and they somewhat answered to him. So Massasoit was a very influential Indian chief in that area where the pilgrims landed. And then the last point of the six terms of the treaty was that the meetings were to be attended essentially unarmed. And that was certainly to set people at ease and to help build trust. The interesting thing about this is the peace lasted until 1675. Most historians would say that it was, in fact, that peace was broken by an Indian who we know as King Philip in King Philip's War. So for those who would tell us the pilgrims were awful to the Indians, the pilgrims, you know, persecuted the Indians, not quite. In fact, we're going to see a couple other places where, in fact, the pilgrims treated the Indians far better than the Indians deserved, and they showed much Christian charity to the Indians, but also recognizing the sinfulness of man that the Indians could be a threat to them. We'll see some of that later. So April 1st, the peace treaty signed with Massasoit. April 5th, the Mayflower departs. Again, I said, and Pastor Bringy also said, no pilgrim passengers on board. None at all. And remember, April, it's not like they had the whole summer to see how things were going to turn out. Okay, April 5th, you know, the winter's tailing off. They're just meeting these Indians. They've only known Squanto for 2 weeks. They don't really know how this Squanto, you know, it's easy for us to look back and see how things turned out. They've only known Squanto for 2 weeks. They don't know how this Indian thing is really going to turn out. But yet they stayed. They showed faithfulness in this vision that God gave them. As we move into May, and we see, again, back to this theme of the sun rising on the pilgrim colony, and also the importance of marriage and family to the pilgrims, we see in May 12th is the first marriage in the new colony. Now, this is a little bit bittersweet, because it was, in fact, Edward Winslow. Remember, he was the one who we think probably wrote most of Mort's Relation, and he was arguably the primary ambassador to the other Indian tribes. He was, as of March 24th, really 6 weeks earlier, he was a widower. Okay, and then Susanna White, she was widowed back in February 21st of the same year. They married. It's the first marriage in the new colony. So certainly, as we've said before, things are definitely looking up. Pastor Bringy mentioned the corn that was found when the pilgrims came that they took for themselves. There wasn't a name tag on the corn. They didn't know whose it was. They did, at the time they took it, resolve to pay back whoever's it was. And in fact, in June, they did that very same thing. Okay, this is the pilgrims understanding God's law with regard to human relationships. They know that they took something out of necessity that was not theirs, and they knew that it was their duty to pay it back. And they saw that duty through in June, probably about six or so months after they had taken that corn. Around this time, there was another Indian came to live with them. We're not sure exactly when he shows up, but he's mentioned at about the June time frame in William Bradford's work. His name, we might have heard of it, is Hobomok. He is also of the Wampanoag tribe. Remember, I said that's the only tribal name I'm going to mention, right? That's the same tribe that Massasoit comes from. He's probably somewhat of a prince or an elder in that tribe. He probably has some bit of rank within the tribe. Something that's interesting about Hobomok is that Bradford describes him as a lusty man, and we're probably taken aback in our day and age by that term lusty, but back then, a man who was lusty was a man who was brawny. He was a big Indian. He was the Indian you wanted on your side, not on the other guy's side. And Bradford says of Hobomok that he continued very faithful and constant to the English till he died. Now, we don't see nearly as much of Hobomok in the pilgrim history as we do Squanto, but in fact, Hobomok died in 1642. So he was faithfully part of the pilgrims for 21 years. Probably doing a lot of the same thing that Squanto did, just not recorded as obviously as Squanto's contribution. Now we move on to August. I don't have a whole lot to say about July, unfortunately. But August, we see an interesting door opening into how the pilgrims saw their relationship with the Indians that showed both their wisdom with regard to the character of fallen man as well as their Christian charity. Squanto and Hobomok had been threatened by another Indian chief of another tribe, one who was in fact under Massasoit but who did not like the English. His name was Corbettant. We might be throwing too many names out here, but Corbettant was trying to sow some discord among the Indians to get them to not like the English, even though Massasoit obviously was very much pro-English, if that's the right term to use. So Squanto and Hobomok are going to visit Corbettant, and then and what happens is that Corbettant is threatening to kill Squanto, apparently, and Hobomok runs back to the pilgrims, and he says, Corbettant has Squanto, and he might have killed him, and so the pilgrims wisely say, this is not something that we can just ignore Squanto. Not only has he taken it upon himself to help us, now, Ephraim, this is August, so we've got a bit more history now with Squanto, but also, any sign of weakness could be seen as an opening by which the Indians could attack this colony. Remembering, they ended with 50 people at the tail end of winter. Okay, another ship hasn't come. There's still 50 people. All right. And there's a whole bunch of Indians out there, and not all of them are friendly. Massasoit and the people who answer to him are generally friendly, but not all of them are. So Captain Standish is sent off. This is where the histories divide a little bit. Mort's Relation book says that there were 10 men. Bradford says there were 14. I'm not too worried about the numbers there. They go off to rescue Squanto. Now, it's almost comical what happens. It's a rainy night. They want to attack at night. Hobomok gets lost. He's the Indian. He's supposed to know where he's going. But another one of the pilgrims had recently been in the area where this other tribe was, and he figures out where they are. They actually do end up attacking the village at night and do not find Squanto. They don't find Corbettant either. But they actually hold the village until daylight. And at that point, they secure Squanto's release. At some point in the melee, there were two Indians who were injured. And Indians who the pilgrims were particularly after. They really were just after this wayward chief. And they had the pilgrims had, in fact, resolved to cut off the head of this chief if they found Squanto had been murdered. Fortunately, Squanto was not murdered, as we know. But even in this instance, you know, the pilgrims could have said, well, you all are part of Corbinton's group and we're mad at all of you, but they didn't do that. The two Indians who were injured were brought back to the Plymouth colony and they were nursed back to health and then let go back to their home. And there's actually a very detailed account about this incident in Mort's relation. So with the pilgrims, we see a recognition that sinful man has to be dealt with as sinful man, but also we see an enormous amount of Christian charity, that they were gentle with the remainder of the inhabitants of this village. So that's a significant event in August. Now we move on into September, and this is another interesting view into the pilgrim relationships with the Indians. Squanto takes 10 pilgrims to find tribes with which to trade for beaver pelts. Now let's take a little step back, okay? Remember that when the pilgrims came over, they had to have funding to come over. They didn't have a whole lot of money, and part of that is due to the history in the Netherlands. I'll let you read Plymouth Plantation. You can find out why they didn't have a whole lot of money. So they had to enter into a contract with some investors with the idea that the pilgrims would get beaver pelts. You know, we have these nice hats we need to make and all this other stuff back in England. And so, essentially, the pilgrims indentured themselves to an investment company so that they were required to send back a certain number of pelts and other goods from the New World back to England. So almost of necessity, they had to go trade for beaver pelts, which they did. Squanto took them out and did that. And in fact, they found a group of Indian women who had pelts to trade. But Squanto actually wanted to take advantage of these Indian women because they were from a bad tribe, from a tribe that he didn't like, that I guess was warlike, the historical details are a little bit sketchy on that. But it was the pilgrims who insisted on the fact, no, we will make a fair trade with these Indians. We will not, even if they're from a quote-unquote bad tribe, we are not going to cheat them. We will treat them fairly. We will get them the price that they asked for these pelts. Now, as we close out this period of time and as we approach this first Thanksgiving, Bradford writes, just before he mentions this first Thanksgiving, he mentions, all the summer there was no want. Now, think about back to England, the persecution, the being told that you have to worship this way, even though it's not in the Scripture. And then think about their time in Holland. We didn't cover a whole lot of some of those details, but in fact, the pilgrim existence in Holland was pretty difficult for reasons we don't need to get into right now. Maybe we'll do that some other year. And then you see what happened over the winter, where half of them died. And they weren't eating a whole lot either. But yet, then summer, as the sun is rising on this colony, all the summer, there was no want. Now let's talk about the first Thanksgiving. Unfortunately, the pilgrims did not know that Thanksgiving was going to be such a big deal, right, 400 years later, okay? So we have two one-paragraph descriptions of the first Thanksgiving, not a whole lot to work with, but here's what we can tell. First of all, there were at least three days of rest and feasting. Men of that period tended to enjoy physical games like running and wrestling, and there probably was some shooting, competitions or demonstrations and stuff. We know that Massasoit brought 90 Indians. Now think about this. Think about the trust here and the relationships the pilgrims had with the Indians. Here's 50 pilgrims. I mean, 51, 52, approximately 50 pilgrims. Here's 90 Indians, and you're more or less on their home turf, and you can't call the National Guard to come rescue you because you are the National Guard, okay? But the Indians actually brought five deer. There were four pilgrims sent out. They caught, as it was described, enough fowl to last a week. Now, was that turkeys? Was that ducks? Was that geese? We don't know, okay? We do know, not specifically from the description of the Thanksgiving, but from descriptions of the crops and that they grew and some of the things that Squanto taught them, we know that at least there was corn and barley. We know that there were, that the peas grew well, but at the end of the harvest season, the sun kind of scorched the peas, so a little bit of a disappointing crop of peas. If you don't like peas, I guess you're good there, right? But quite honest, it's quite possible that that first Thanksgiving included eels. In fact, I think it was in Mort's Relation, the eels were described as fat and sweet. So is anybody planning to eat any fat and sweet eels this coming Thursday? I'm going to guess not, right? But also they probably had some fish and also some shellfish. So if you want to have lobster with your Thanksgiving and feel historical, you can do that, all right? But as we think about, why do they have this Thanksgiving? Where did this come from? Did they just make it up out of thin air? No. As we look at Scripture, and there's too much Scripture to mention here, but certainly God's people having feasts of Thanksgiving in honor of the Lord and His provision is a scriptural pattern, especially as we look at the Old Testament, right? We have the Feast of Unleavened Bread, right? We have the Feast of Weeks. You have the Feast of Ingathering. And we have some other feasts as well that are less major there. So there's a scriptural pattern of having feasts. In fact, the Feast of Booths is the Old Testament feast, which would have ended the harvest season and been the end of the growing season. And so there is already a biblical pattern for God's people to celebrate and give thanks to God at the end of the agricultural season for that year. But here's another interesting thing, and John alluded to that a little bit. In fact, we talked about the Spanish siege of Leiden, and that siege was lifted in 1574, all right? Well, in October 3rd, in fact. Well, every year in Leiden on October 3rd, they had a Thanksgiving celebration to celebrate the lifting of the Spanish siege. So the pilgrims were in Leiden from 1609 through 1620. Now, they weren't in Leiden October 3rd of 1620. So 1609 through 1619, they were in a town that had a big Thanksgiving celebration in the fall. Okay, so this is not something new to the pilgrims. Certainly, their cause for Thanksgiving was different from the cause of Leiden. But I want to end then, as we talk about this first Thanksgiving, with a quote from both of the historical references regarding this, regarding the first Thanksgiving. These comments were made in the context of the first Thanksgiving. First, from Mort's Relation. "And although it be not always so plentiful as it was at this time, yet by the goodness of God we are so far from want that we often wish you partakers of our plenty." Now remember, this was in 1622, so the author of Mort's Relation is recognizing that the summer of 1621 was particularly good. Okay, he says it's not always so plentiful as it was at this time. "Yet by the goodness of God we are so far from want that we often wish you partakers of our plenty." Now, maybe the challenge for us is this. In a culture that tells us we're supposed to be discontent because you're supposed to have what your neighbor just got at the store, or your whatever you have now isn't fast enough, isn't bright enough, isn't whatever enough, can we say that about ourselves? I mean, we've got it so much better materially than the pilgrims. Or have we let our material blessings maybe corrupt us a bit? Something to ask ourselves. Now as we go to William Bradford, what he says at this time. "And thus they found the Lord to be with them in all their ways, and to bless their outgoings and incomings, for which Let His holy name have the praise forever to all posterity. Now let's think about that, okay? Think about this. We have the pilgrims at Thanksgiving. Yes, they've had a relatively speaking, a great summer. Okay? There's still 50 of them. You think they forgot that half of them died not too long ago? Probably not. Right? But yet, they found the Lord to be with them in all their ways, to bless their outgoings and incomings, for which let His holy name have the praise forever to all posterity. Thank you.